Thanks so much to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Sentry knows that your code is broken, and they just want to help you fix it. There's lots of ways to catch errors in your code today. You could do automated testing or click testing, but you're always going to miss edge cases there. You could rely on error reports from your users, but that's just a bad experience overall. Your users are going to be upset, and you're not going to get complete information about the error and be able to recreate it at all. Or you could use Sentry and get detailed contextual information for every crash. You get a stack trace, you get the git commit where that error was introduced, and the developer to blame for it. You can even configure it to know about application releases and who your users are, so you can track the trends of errors over time and who's causing the most errors. You'll even get a breadcrumb trail, which gives you everything that happened leading up to the error. For example, in JavaScript, you'll get console log statements, navigation history, URL requests, AJAX, all that sort of stuff, so you can help recreate the problem. It'll even integrate with deployment pipelines, so some errors won't even make it to production at all. There's first-party support for many clients and server platforms and languages, like our favorites, Vue.js, Rails, and Elixir. So, head on over to Sentry.io and give it a try. There's a free developer account, no credit card required, and it's perfect for personal projects and early-stage applications. Sentry.io. Your code is broken. Let's fix it together.
So, yeah, how was your week?
Just another crazy week here, dude. Lots of just head down, scratching my head. I've got a pile of... So, like, I keep a paper notepad on my desk, kind of old school, but just to scratch down things if I need to remember to do something, or just trying to draw something out or think something out and take notes on them on a call or whatever. And, yeah, let's see. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different block diagrams here. Here they are. And,
block diagram.
Yeah. So like I've been, trying to wrap my head around like things like UDP hole punching and, basically how to traverse firewalls and NATs with, UDP data. Cause this is really important.
I don't know what you're talking about, man.
So turns out establishing a peer-to-peer connection on the modern internet is hard. And, I wanted to see if it was something that we could do ourselves, because it's really performant if you can do that, because we have to stream UDP data back and forth between user's computer and our stations for various, you can get audio data over it, you can get all kinds of other, real-time streaming data over that. And traditionally in the past, we've used WebRTC because you know what? WebRTC is awesome and it quote-unquote just works. Like, It's really, really amazing. If you're just doing audio and video streams and you have a your own Stun Turn server that you host, which provides basically a relay. It's like a proxy server in the event that the two ends of the call can't establish like a direct connection.
Okay.
WebRTC is awesome. Once you've put all the pieces in place, it's magical. And it deals with all that stuff for you. It deals with hole punching. It tries to basically establish a peer-to-peer connection whenever it can. And if it doesn't, if it's not able to do that, it always can always fall back to the relay case, which will work 100% of the time, right? In fact, a couple weeks ago, our Turn server went down. We just had an issue with it. It's just a little open source process that I just run alongside the Rails server on our AWS box is all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that we had an issue with that and the process died. And we got a ton of tickets because without that ability to relay packets between users who are almost certainly behind a NAT and our ham radio sites, which are definitely most of them are behind NATs as well. It's like, yeah, it was chaos until we figured out that's what was going on, because people just could not establish a connection. So anyway, long story short, I just wanted to see if we could roll our own, try to get some extra performance out of doing this UDP packet stuff, and it's just not worth it, man.
So was rolling your own sort of like what you said? You just said you wanted to get some more performance out of it. Was it somewhat of an educational thing too? You wanted to see if it was doable?
I wasn't doing it with the intention of learning. I mean, I learned a lot in the process, but no, the reason really I was thinking about it really just came down to, pre-optimization when I really shouldn't be doing that,
50% of the time.
50% of the time what?
That's what you said to me last week. We were talking about abstractions and stuff and premature optimizations.
Right. No,
premature
you're right.
Optimizations, like when you know, but.
Yeah, and this is a gamble it's not worth, because I just don't know enough about the problem space to even mm-hmm. know if it's going to be a problem. So, and I know it's definitely will work on some level. Because we use it every day, and it's, you know, we built our business on it. We're really good at doing WebRTC stuff, so I'm just gonna keep leveraging that.
Yeah, that's still pretty cool, though. I mean, that I'm sure that's just more experience for you down the road, which you can't ever go wrong with that.
Yeah, definitely, and it really just comes back to like just did not wanting to reinvent the wheel. You know, I probably could have gotten it working, but there's so many edge cases. There's so many, and you can imagine like you have a problem where. Let's say you did roll your own solution for this UDP streaming stuff, and suddenly, like, someone's having a problem. Like, you can't recreate their network environment,
mm-hmm.
right? It's an unreproducible problem. It's just going to be edge case after edge case that you can't debug, that can't be fixed. Like, I just did not want to go down that road, you know, just anticipating future issues.
Yeah. So you're talking about having an issue that's hard to debug. It depends on a lot of different stuff that you don't necessarily have control or even a view into. I've been kind of fighting with our Elasticsearch provider because we're using Bonsai Box, I think it's called, on Heroku, and they don't provide, or what they do is they heavily limit concurrent indexes for the Elasticsearch endpoint. So really what you should do is say if you have a couple thousand or whatever documents that need to be updated, let's say you have a store and you changed a setting and that needs to like change prices for products or something. And so you have to update all of your products in the index. That should be run request to the bulk API endpoint. So it just turns out that the Elasticsearch client for Elixir doesn't have any hooks into the bulk endpoint besides creating an index. So like you can't bulk update records. So we have to do them one by one right now. And what makes this fun is that Bonsai has some sort of proxy that sits in front of their endpoints and has some sort of arbitrary rate request limit. And that's not documented anywhere. There's not like a hard number saying you can't do more than X requests. And the error you get back is, hey, you should think about not doing concurrent indexing because we don't support that.
Even if you're not doing concurrent, it could just be back-to-back sequential things. So, but if it's too fast, it'll throw you that error.
Oh, yeah. So what I ended up doing was we use Redis a lot for our jobs. We don't really persist anything in Redis. We just use it for a queue, like a queue that can retry and things like that. So if, you know, in the case of Heroku restarting our Dyno, we won't lose a bunch of stuff in progress. And so what I ended up doing was making it sounds so bad when I say it, but I made a queue just for Elasticsearch and it has a concurrency setting of 1. And the jobs are running so fast. And so this is how I learned it wasn't actually, because I was looking around for some sort of setting because maybe I thought that you could actually turn concurrent indexing off via an Elasticsearch setting. So I was looking around for that. I didn't find anything. So I made that index with a concurrency of 1, the queue with a concurrency of 1, and I started sending jobs to it, and they were still performing so quickly that the same message was coming back. Concurrent indexing is not supported, but what it really actually is a rate limit, right? So there's no way for me to know what that actually is. So what I ended up doing was I made another index, and I connected my development box to it. And I started queuing stuff up and just inserting timer.sleep and increasing the milliseconds until the error stopped happening.
Oh my God.
Well, what else am I supposed to do? Like so in looking at GitHub, there was an issue, someone opened an issue about this and the library author said, hey, yeah, I'm aware. I'm actually in the middle of a pretty big rewrite of this that exposes all the internals. So that would give you a way to hook into that stuff if you need to. But there's no time frame of when it's going to be done. It's just this guy that's doing it in his own time. And, so it's one of those things where I have a lot of stuff to do. I could probably PR that, but he probably won't merge it because he's doing it himself already. And so it's a matter of how do I make the pain stop or the errors stop? Like, how do I make this just work for now and hope that the library doesn't take so long to update?
Right. So really you're just kind of triaging the problem until the library gets fixed, basically. Like you and I were brainstorming, like, what's the stupidest, easiest solution that we could do just to fix this for now?
Right.
Knowing that you can fix it properly later and do the bulk uploads or reindexing or whatever.
I was racking my brains, too, because you can't use Observer, right? So it'd be pretty easy. So the thing that kicks this off, it's sort of like a callback. So if a certain setting changes, then the products need to be reindexed. So it gets kicked off inside of a task. And once the task cycles off, that means that it's outside of the request lifecycle. So that means the user's browser is sitting there waiting for these to happen. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe the task is like splintering in different processes somehow. That sounds crazy, right? But I couldn't actually, I had no visibility into this. I can't use Observer, so I can't actually see what processes are starting up. And I was just kind of dead in the water. So we were at this point, I didn't think that there could, it was actually just a rate, like an arbitrary rate limit. I was taking them at their error message word, so to speak, because it says, hey, this feature is turned off. It sounds like this feature is turned off, not, hey, we're actually limiting the number of requests you can make per second. And, it was a tough one. So that's, I don't know, it brought, like when you said that you were trying to solve this problem where you didn't have a lot of control, like you can't, you know, even if I wanted to set up a proxy in front of my local Elasticsearch server, I still don't know what the actual rate request limit is.
Right. And so you just determined it, what's the word, experimentally or?
Yeah, just guessing. I don't know.
So just guessing. What it ended up being for the sleep?
80 milliseconds seems to be okay.
80 milliseconds?
Yeah.
It's not that much.
It's just enough to be annoying because 80 milliseconds times, I don't know, like 5,000 products, 4,000 products, depending on a store. Like that'd be a big store. Most stores don't have that many, but
the whole length of the request is probably 100 milliseconds or something, right?
Exactly. It's really, yeah, sometimes even less than that. It's not much, but it's just one of those things where it, like you said, it was just kind of a black box and I didn't really have a way to really know anything. And again, even that solution, it seems to be working, but it's still based on a complete guess, you know? So that was fun. Yeah.
I was going to say you could just retry a bunch and do like a back off mechanism, but that runs the risk of just overriding, you know, hitting the rate limit anyways, just with the retries. So it doesn't really help you.
Right. Yeah. And that's so I love Elixir and I love the ecosystem, but some things are just pretty young still. So like if you look at any sort of the queue setups, like XQ or I think there's one called Verk or anything like that, there's so many issues saying like, hey, we need this to happen. We need that to happen. We need unique jobs and we need, and it's just, I don't know, it's just young, I guess. And so some of these issues, some of these pain points that I'm having seem to be stemming from a young ecosystem. But that's just, I don't know. Elixir is just a really good language. I guess it's maybe the only trade-off I've had to make so far is wishing that, I mean, granted, I could shut my mouth and contribute some PRs, but really at the end of the day, I don't have time. So.
Yeah, I ran into similar issues dealing with AWS APIs. There's the Ben Wilson, who's pretty active in the community. He wrote most of the Absinthe, you know, with the other guy. I can't think of his name right now, but Bruce. Anyway, yeah, Ben maintains the AWS Elixir client library, and it's the same thing that you're having. It's like it supports like some subset of the API, but not all of it. And sometimes you just need that one thing that's not there and you have to like, mm-hmm. Do I fork it and add it in there? Do I just hand do it? Do I do a PR? Like, cause maybe you don't want to do a full implementation of what that call is. And there was even a discussion in the Elixir Slack today about coherence, right? I know you've had, that's a big pain point for you, right? And coherence is one of those libraries that like started off as a devise clone, for lack of a better term, for Phoenix. And the maintainer is like MIA and it's just sitting there and the dependencies are getting outdated, as you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just a contentious issue because like there hasn't really been anything else that's been better or better suited to like how Elixir and Phoenix operates, right? And in terms of extensibility and explicitness and just tying everything together. And plus, don't even get me started on JWTs. For it's a whole thing. The whole Elixir Slack has been just like a I don't know, fist fight.
War zone.
Fist fight this past week. It's kind of fun to just watch.
Yeah, I like how you alert me. Like, hey, there's an argument going on about CSS and JS. I think it was a couple weeks ago. And Coherence, I think it was today even, Coherence. So what's interesting is that I am transitioning to spending more time. So Paul's been kind of like doing head of product stuff anyway. He's been focusing a lot on that. And there's like outstanding things that we want to add to the platform, but there's nothing that we like need to be able to make a sale to a store. So, and traffic has been picking up. It's like, it's good. We're growing. And so I'm able to, and I was given the permission to like spend more of my time focusing on performance enhancements and maintenance and, posturing for growth, I guess. And so on my short list of things to do with the next couple of weeks is actually remove coherence or coherence dependency.
That's probably not a small task because that's been in there since the beginning, right? I mean, it's tied into your whole authentication mechanism.
So yes and no. Yes and no. So over the last year and a half, I've been slowly replacing it from the inside out. And it was causing problems because, again, we're on Heroku. It was causing problems because sessions were stored in an agent. So if you have two dynos, that was a real issue. You had to turn that off. So our sessions are actually just stored in Postgres anyway. So we're really not depending on coherence for much. I think I've actually even like replaced most of the controllers for authentication, because at the point that we went API client split, Coherence didn't even have JSON controllers or anything. So I did that myself. And so the goal is to be able to put a fake like DK Coherence replacement, and anywhere Coherence that current user is used, we would just use ours instead. And then that way I could just junk the dependency and get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, basically what would be left, just the JWTs in those existing sessions, would be the only like remnants of that, right?
Yeah, and so there's like locking and stuff, which we don't really use a whole lot. There's confirmations and stuff, but again, like I have already replaced those controllers with API compatible controllers. So there's like maybe a handful of coherence library functions that are used that I could replace. And the code is like very much Phoenix 1.2. It's like everything's done in the controllers. So it's not great. And luckily, like I said, I've already done a lot of work looking forward to this moment in time where I'd be able to rip it out. So luckily it's not the case where it's so much part of the backbone that it would be like a week long project to do it. It should only take me a few days to get rid of it.
What are you doing for all those other features like password resets and that kind of stuff? You just roll your own?
Yeah, it's just in Postgres, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Just kind of took it over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So looking forward to that. So that's what I've been doing actually today and yesterday, the last 2 days, is I've been upgrading us to Phoenix 1.4 and Ecto 3.0.
Woohoo.
And it's been a slog because I've just been so busy. It's awesome because I had a long talk. I keep mentioning this. I had a long talk with my boss at the beginning of the year and just saying how important this stuff is to keep up with. And I need to be able to treat this stuff like features. And she heard me because I'm actually spending time on this stuff. And I feel like, sometimes you spend time on something that you want to spend time on and it feels like you're pushing something else that's more important off. This doesn't feel like that at all, which is awesome. But yeah, so I mentioned to her, like, hey, it's been a while since I've updated dependencies. There's some pretty like, major version changes and we need to get on that stuff. And so that's what I've been doing, is just slogging through that, fixing tests, trying to remove deprecation warnings, trying to decide if I want to include milliseconds or not or microseconds or not in my timestamps and stuff. And it's been interesting to say the least.
I mean, having that test suite must be really empowering, because you can do stuff like this and know that you're going to come out the other side eventually, right?
Yeah. Well, yes and no, because we actually just crossed the 1,000 test mark. So yeah, there's a lot of tests in there. So I feel pretty good about that. But there's also, I know there's edge cases that I haven't tested or didn't think to test. So So what I ended up doing was I ended up going into Google Docs and setting up sort of a Q&A script. And every time we hit a bug that it, like every time we find a bug that gets in production, that's like an edge case or something that was missed or just like skipped in testing, I add that there so that way we don't miss it again. And that makes that actually makes me feel a lot better because these complex edge case scenarios are outlined like do A, B, C, and then D, and it's there in writing, black and white, crystal clear, right? And that makes me feel like the test suite's nice, but I don't know why, but that makes me feel more, that just makes me feel better about stuff because I'm seeing it with my eyeballs, I guess.
So by updating the dependencies, is this mostly just like a maintenance thing or are you looking for any new features in particular that like you needed that, that warranted this change? Or is it just like because you can or it's been a while, like what prompted this?
All of the above.
I mean, those are all legit reasons.
Yeah. It was too long. Like it was something that I would think about occasionally and then I would get into it and I didn't have enough time to actually finish it or ship that update, right? Other things would need to be attended to. So like you mentioned XAWS and thankful to Ben for, you know, stewarding that library. But like you said, it was kind of piecemeal. And so there was a major rewrite. I think it was 2.0. It was pretty different. And it solved a number of problems that we needed solved. So, you know, there's one positive there. Another thing is that I'm adding... So up until this point, we haven't really had any like structured or dedicated performance metrics or monitors. So like New Relic or Scout or anything like that. We've just been using Heroku's graphs because they were good enough TM, good enough for now. And so I'm working on adding New Relic into the stack. Turns out that New Relic requires Cowboy 2.0. It turns out that adding Cowboy 2.0 into my dependency tree means that I have to update XAWS and I have to update XQ and I have to update all these other dependencies. So I was like, well, I'm at it. Why not just hit Phoenix 1.4?
Right. Because 1.4 also requires that, I think, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and it's not like I'm looking forward to anything specific from Cowboy 2. I know it has like HTTP2 support and other things, but it was really just kind of, there were a number of small paper cuts that were happening and they were annoying. And I think, I guess they just kind of like reached a threshold to where it's like, now it makes sense to spend time on this. I'm not having to spend all of my time on feature builds and I'm not having to spend all my time on bug fixes, which is great. So now I actually have time to spend on the things that will make sure that I won't be spending all of my time on bug fixes later once traffic picks up more.
Yeah, I think that's definitely worth your time. And, you know, the sooner you can do it, the better, right?
Right.
It's not going to get any easier.
And it's almost like I don't want to see how long it's been since I've actually like updated dependency because it's been too long, but just had other stuff to do. I've just been so busy, had been so busy up to this point. But now I'm able to focus on making it better and faster. And it feels like, so like in a small company, you have to wear many hats, right? And I feel like now I'm finally doing my CTO job with this stuff. Whereas before I was doing product work and I was doing support and I was doing all this other stuff. And not that that's not CTO work, but it feels like more like this is what I'll be doing. Say we had another couple engineers that are working on product, that are working on that side of things, I would be able to spend all of my time on this stuff, right? So it feels like I'm finally beginning to move in the direction of the work that I want to be doing anyway, which is kind of cool.
You know, you're not so willing to give up a date, but I'll give you a date.
Oh, no.
You ready for this? January 16th, 2016. That was the last time that I made a commit to the repository for SodaGoat, one of my iOS applications.
How many iOS apps do you have?
So I've got two apps. One is called Waveguide, all one word, and it's kind of a play on words with ARF engineering. I'll link in the show notes. Waveguides. Anyway, Waveguide. They're both ham radio utilities. Waveguide is it pulls down data from a couple different websites and kind of shows you current activities on the ham band. So it shows like on a map visually who's making contacts with who, and you can filter and search and that kind of stuff. So it's good for, you know, just seeing what's going on the air.
That's really cool.
That's on iPhone and iPad as well. I'll put links to these in the show notes.
SodaGoat is an all-in-one utility for summits, on the air activators and chasers.
So SodaGoat requires a little more explanation. So there's this program in Hymn Radio called Summits on the Air, SOTA. That's the soda. And what it is a, it's like a, I don't want to say contest, but it's a, it's just like a fun event that you can do where they have this huge database of mountaintops all over the globe. And each mountaintop has a particular point value associated from 1 to 10, depending on like how high the summit is or how hard it is to reach. And yeah, you go up to the summit and you haul up all your radio gear with you. You bring up some batteries and a radio and antenna, a microphone, and, you know, whatever amount of gear you want. And as long as you make 4 contacts from that summit, you have successfully activated it.
Hmm.
And then you put it in a big database and you get points for it and bragging rights pretty much. So it's just a fun way to kind of experience a hobby in a different way and like practice, you know, portable operations, see how light you can get your setup, how much of a compromise antenna you can tolerate under different band conditions, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a, I don't want to say like prepper survivalist, but it definitely has that kind of, you know, interest.
Yeah, that's really cool. So if you for some reason needed to update the dependencies for this, how do you think you would approach that?
Right. So yeah, so SodaGoat is just a utility application I wrote for that. So it has the entire database of all the summits, which right now there's 130,000 summits. So it's a big database. And then it also lists spots. So like if someone is, again, making contact with someone else, you can see that in real time. They, you know, report it on a site and it pulls it down. So yeah, this is challenging because I haven't had the, like you've mentioned before, like not having the time or effort to like support updating these things, right? The app continues to work. It still runs today. SodaGoat still runs. And if you look on the screenshots on the site, it's actually like iOS 6 and like an
right,
iPhone
I was just
4.
Looking at that.
Like I didn't even update the screenshots on the site with the new UI, which is pretty bad. I'll definitely do that with this new release. But oh, man, it's a whole other set of challenges when you're updating these types of applications because your dependencies are not only like, there's very few third-party dependencies in SodaGoat, right? It's mostly just all framework code, but it's the framework that changes so much from iOS to iOS, right? And you don't have any control of that. You have no recourse. You keep marching forward and you download the new version of Xcode and you better freaking update and migrate your code or else you're going to be left in the dust. And eventually your app will just be taken off the App Store because they don't want to support it, you know?
Yeah, that is a little different. I mean, so it's interesting. I was asking you because I was hoping you could give me some insight to help me finish this tomorrow. that's what I've been wanting to do. But yeah, it's a little bit different situation because, you know, I have things like that are, I guess, framework level, you know, like Phoenix, but luckily the Phoenix 1.3, 1.4 changes weren't that big. I think the biggest change that I'm working through now is Ecto 3, so Ecto 2.x to 3.0, because that definitely has some breaking changes, but there's nothing I think as big as just straight like framework changes, because at that point the framework's controlling all the UI on top of everything else too. So I think that's kind of like another level of complexity on top of things.
Yeah, and even if the framework hasn't changed, like its API hasn't changed, it still might behave differently because they fix stuff and they break stuff on new releases. So it's like something that previously worked might not anymore. I think this was previously targeting iOS 6 or 7 with my releases,
mm-hmm.
you target like the minimum version you want to support. And with this new version that I'm, you know, working on, I think I target iOS 9 because that's still has a small amount of market share, right? So 9, 10, 11, and 12 are, you know, the current ones that I'm going to support. And yeah, when I updated the project, it had, luckily it's still compiled, thank God. There were no hard, you know, deprecations, but I did have 100 plus deprecation warnings, which means like your code works now, but you better friggin' take care of it. And it's nice to have a clean slate with zero warnings, right?
Yeah, it really is. That's one thing I'm working through now is that there are so many just different warnings. So like, for example, ecto.multi, for the run function, run 3, I think it has run 3 and run 5, Arities. I think run three, when you pass it an anonymous function, it's no longer a one argument anonymous function, it's two. So you have to take the repo and then the changes so far. And I use multi all over the place. So luckily that wasn't that difficult because it was a pretty easy like find and pretty, you know, mindless replace, because if it's a new argument, I haven't already been using it. So just underscore and put it in, you know, and it's fine. Like I'm getting console warnings for the decimal library. I think it is warning about, yeah, so doing decimal.new with a float, it's saying it's going to lose precision, so you should do decimal.from float instead. So it's all good stuff. And that's one thing I want to give props to the Elixir community for, is the changes that are coming in are actually really good, and it's making sure that you're being more specific than less specific, which I like a whole lot. It's just, I don't know, it's a lot to slog through sometimes, but I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty thankful. So I guess if you're in my situation and you're doing a Phoenix update and you're doing an Ecto 2-3 change, if you were in that situation, I guess, how would you approach it? Is there any sort of like life cycle or like workflow that you follow?
I mean, the biggest strategy is just doing it more often. You know what I mean? Just I mean, it's,
yeah,
it's kind of a cop-out answer, but like when you think of it, or, you know, like I think you mentioned, like, did you set yourself a scheduled task to remind yourself to do this?
Yes.
Now in the future? Yeah. So that's pretty powerful, right? I don't know. There's no good way to do it, because it's like, it's one of those things you really just have to do. And it's never going to be easy, right? I mean, especially when you have breaking changes, when you have warnings, at least like there's usually helpful error messages that explain like, hey, this is the old way, this is the new way, here's how you change it, right? Xcode is actually very, very good at it. And sometimes like if it's an easy fix, there'll be a, like you're in Xcode and there's a warning that says, you know, this is the old way of doing it. And then just a button that says fix. You click fix and it just changes your code to the new whatever style.
Yeah, that's neat.
Don't even get me. And now, of course, SodaGoat's all on Objective-C still.
Okay.
So when you're dealing with Swift version upgrades, that's a whole even like other set of challenges you have to deal with, is like the language changes in breaking ways with each new major release. And again, Xcode is pretty good about the migration process there, but man, it doesn't get everything, and you still gotta learn the new stuff, right? So
Swift changes pretty often, doesn't it?
Yeah, once a year, I think they have a major release.
Oh man,
seems like.
So let's see, 2016, 2017, 2018, 20. I'm just thinking about.
They're on Swift 5 now, I think. So yeah, luckily Objective C is not changing, and it's still very well supported. Like everything just works. Although it's getting harder and harder to find modern libraries for it, because everything's being written for Swift, which it should be. Swift is objectively better in every single way. But
I see what you did there.
Oh,
get it?
Wow.
Well, I guess like maybe I can tell you how I've been working through this this stuff.
Yeah, I mean you have the benefit of having a test suite, which is awesome. I think it's kind of, it makes it more daunting, because you see all the problems are just laid out in front of you, and you gotta deal with them one at a time, right?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that it feels like a lot of the tests that failed were there were very few syntax, just like straight syntax changes that needed to happen, and it feels like a lot of the tests that are failing are because it was just kind of a bad test anyway. Or like it assumed too much, or what it was actually like asserting wasn't specific enough, if that makes sense. And so, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe you brought this up before we started recording, but I'm putting this in the show notes, but I have a blog post that has just kind of like a preliminary list of breaking changes from Ecto 2 to Ecto 3. And one of the big ones was some stuff to do with the calendar type. So before, you would have like naive daytime and UTC daytime. And in my mind, that cool, we're using UTC daytime for things. And now with version 3, there is UTC daytime, naive daytime, but also naive daytime USEC, or USEEC, and UTC daytime USEC. And the UTC daytime, for example, doesn't it doesn't keep track of any microseconds, and UCC daytime USEC does. And so when you're upgrading to Ecto 3, you have to make a decision. Is that a precision that we're willing to lose? Or is like having microseconds in our timestamps, is that important to us? And so what I did was I was like, all right, well, it's never bad to have more information, right? So I made the change to make sure that we're using the microsecond version. And suddenly I had tests that were sometimes passing and sometimes failing because they're asserting based off of times, right? So like a sale should be ready to start now and you set up test data. So like make this test ready to start, make this test ready to expire. And now because we're considering microseconds, depending on how long it takes the code to actually run, a test can fail or pass.
Oh yeah, that should not be the case.
Right. That's what I mean. So they weren't great tests before, but we got away with it. And so I guess maybe what I keep saying, like, it's making me be more specific, but maybe what I mean to say is, like, it's letting me get away with less things.
They really should have, because Elixir supports UTF-8 characters, so they really should have put the proper mu character in that type name.
Yeah, so that was, I think that's really, like, the biggest change that affected me, because I'm going through and, like, fixing tests and rewriting tests to make them better. It seemed like pattern matching changed a little bit, too, for whatever reason. I was asserting a match on a change set. So for example, if I'm asserting that you can't have a duplicate something, I would say error change set, and then I would actually say errors name, and then what is it, a tuple? So it'd be like name is already taken or has to be unique or something like that. So that's what I was matching on, and that worked before. But now it actually wants me to actually say, I have to actually say the name of the index, right? So before I didn't have to specify that in the match, but now I do. And so again, there's a number of tests that they were asserting I'm probably just not enough. And so now I'm going through and fixing that, which is nice. But the process basically has been, I know I need to get to Phoenix 1.4. So I'll tick that in my, what's it called, mix.exs file, and I'll do mix.depths.get and just see what happens, and then go down the tree and toggle those version numbers, and basically I just kept doing that until the thing compiled. And then once it compiled, I started running the tests and started from the top and started working on making the test fix. So I guess that's been kind of my loop is it compiling now, and are the tests passing? And just keep on circling back to those two questions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a smart way to do that. You gotta brute force your way through it. I mean, it feels good though when you get it done, like you have kind of the latest and greatest, and you know you're set yourself up for success for the future, and you have, you know, access to stuff you didn't have before. You know, you'll know exactly the microsecond those sales start. That's important.
The microsecond, yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll go back on that. I'm not sure. It like really, in a business sense, it doesn't make a difference, I don't think. Or I can't think of a case where it would make a difference, really. So it's not like I need to have those there.
Well, that's interesting too, because when you do these sorts of things, I ran into this as well. It makes you really question, do I spend time on fixing this or not? Like, what really matters? I was working on, I don't remember. There's a bunch of deprecation warnings in my iOS app that are related to push notifications. Well, guess what? My push notifications service provider, rest in peace, Parse, went out of business like 2 years ago. My push notifications in my app have not worked for a long time. Mm-hmm. There's still settings in there for them. They just don't do anything. So I have to fix that. So basically, yeah, anything that was a deprecation warning that has to do with push notifications, I just ignored it. Like, I'll come back to it later when I actually fix that. You know what I mean? And I'm probably going to end up ripping most of it out. There's a bunch of stuff I did rip out in the process of, you know, it's easier just to delete stuff than fix it. And
that's true.
It really makes you, forces you to reevaluate the value of each part of the code.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're kind of asking yourself, like, do I even need to have this? And I feel like a lot of times a feature seems like it's something you have to have because other companies have it or other apps do it, but it's kind of good to always ask that question, right? Like, do we actually need one of these things?
Or it just seemed important at the time when you implemented it.
Sure, yeah. In our case too, sometimes it's like one person asked for this and nobody else has. Is it worth the time to implement this change or implement this new feature based off of one person's request?
Yeah, absolutely.
And most times it's no, because it's not like you want to alienate a customer or, you know, make them feel like not important. But again, it's like business goals. We need to make sure that at the end of the day, everyone can sell furniture and everyone can market themselves. And we have the base features to do that. And a lot of the things that people might ask for are kind of like different takes on things. And that's not necessarily bad, but it comes down to, is it going to be worth the money that it's going to cost to change this thing around? Is it going to significantly impact the bottom line of our customer or ourselves, really? Is it worth the money it's going to take, like the engineering time, the design time, like the thinking time, the human hours to do this thing? I'm all about asking those questions, because when I first started this job, it was always a, hey, someone so suggested this thing. All right, let's do it. And so I was so busy. And this kind of like ties into not having time to look after some of this stuff that's important, you know, the back-end infrastructure side of things. It's because I was spending so much time implementing stuff that one person asked for or a couple of people asked for, or making changes based off of assumptions.
So going in the other direction for a second, how do you find yourself resisting the urge to do refactoring as you're stepping through all these pieces of the code, right? Because I get that a lot where I'm dealing with these migration issues and I look at a piece of code, I'm like, oh, this is crufty. Oh, this could be better. Maybe I'll just take a little time and tidy this up. Like, are you doing that as well? Or are you just literally just check the boxes and get it compiling and running again and then come back to it later?
Oh, right now. I mean, in terms of upgrading the dependencies and stuff right now, it's just check the boxes and get it running. I leave notes and things. So I have a Notion notebook full of notes and line numbers and stuff that I want to change. And I guess like if I see something that will legitimately cause a problem later. So there are a few things actually that I haven't solved yet. So for example, we're using, like I mentioned, we're using Elasticsearch, and I believe with Ecto 3.0 and ecto.repo.stream, you no longer can pass in a struct that has preloads in it because it, what's the term that they use? It said it was unpredictable. And it doesn't always lead to the results that you would expect. And that's a pretty big deal, because right now we preload a lot of stuff because a product in our index has to know about a store setting. It has to know about how much like price adjustments it has. It has to know like, should it show that it has shipping included and stuff like that. So we need access and information when we're actually building the document to send to Elasticsearch. So we need to be able to preload that stuff or have it preloaded when we send it in. And so that'll be probably an example of, yeah, it like maybe isn't really part of upgrading the dependency, but it's going to cause an issue as part of this. So it needs to be addressed currently, and it can't really be pushed off until later.
Yeah, definitely. That's sometimes you just got to bite the bullet.
Yeah, but I mean, in general, I kind of look at it like, do I know this is going to cause a problem? Like, is it actually going to cause a bug to happen or like make this really difficult for us to change later, versus does it work fine and is it ugly? Like the last two things, I kind of push those off more, because it's like if it's like a code style or preference thing, and it's not actually causing any real issues, then I can live with that. And I used to just like slide those things into a change and it would just blow diffs up, right? And I try not to do that anymore. So, but yeah, that's how I'm approaching it. Just kind of, is it compiling, and then do the test pass, and either just continue on from there.
Cool. So how far are you? You almost done? You're going to think you're going to finish it tomorrow?
Hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Got some of this time stuff to, I got some of this time stuff to sort out and some tests to rewrite, and I have to figure out the preload thing. So I just put the link in the show notes that I have.
You know what you should do? You should wait till 5 p.m. on Friday.
Oh, man.
And then ship your code and then turn off your phone.
I can't. I can't do that. So Paul, we have, I can't be the combo breaker in Paul and I's relationship. We have a combo going of not shipping after 3 p.m. and on Fridays. I don't want to be the one to break the cycle of responsibility. DM trademarking that right now, cycle of responsibility.
The dependency cycle of responsibility.
Right, which is just my responsibility. So, but yeah, I don't know. We've been doing well at not shipping. We've been doing really, really well at having, like I mentioned, maybe a couple episodes, I've been trying to do like a hard stop at 5, and I've been able to keep that up. Obviously, you know, I have my phone on in case something blows up. And Paul and I are working on figuring out kind of like an on-call schedule, because right now both of us are on call all the time, which isn't great. But I've been doing better at the 5 o'clock cutoff. Like I said, we haven't been shipping anything after 3 or on Fridays or anything. So it's feeling better.
That's a good policy. Well, I will be out of the office tomorrow. Got a flight lesson in the morning. Going to see Captain Marvel. It's my wife on her birthday tomorrow afternoon, so that'll be good.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
That sounds fun. I've actually been in San Francisco a lot. So if anybody in San Francisco hears this, hit me up on Twitter. So I got to catch up with some old friends, some old coworkers, and I'm catching up with an old roommate tomorrow. So that's pretty cool. Hanging out around Mission and 6 around in that area. So if anyone hears that and wants to hang out, let me know.
I don't suppose it's 8 degrees there like it is here, huh?
No, actually, it's pretty nice. I was walking around in a t-shirt the other day.
Jealous.
Yeah, it's nice. It's I think when I'm there, I average between 6 and 8 miles of walking a day.
Damn.
Yeah, so it feels good. Well, if anyone has any more experience than I do in updating their outdated dependencies, please help me, because I don't want to keep doing this forever, this cycle.
At least it's not a Node application. Huh.
It's been surprisingly not terrible. I was actually kind of worried about it, but it's been not bad. Like I said, only 2 days and I'm almost done. So, but if anyone does any feedback, I would like to hear it. And if anybody appreciates my insight on that, I would also like to hear that, because I need to feel good about myself.
We're just looking for validation, folks.
Yeah.
Well, you can validate us on Twitter at DNC Show. If you want to pat Sean's back, at Sean Washbot. And if you want to stroke my ego, at Shrockwell. On Twitter.
And as always, show notes are available at dnc.show. And I put those links I talked about. So for example, I'm just staring at this issue where it says that repo.stream no longer supports preload, and it's making me sad. If you want to look at it too, it's in the show notes, along the other things that we talked about today as well.
We also post the show notes over at spectrum.chat, where you can have a real-time discussion with us real human people who do the show.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a new job, spec.fm has a job board at spec.fm/jobs. And I'm looking at it right now, and there's a lead developer evangelist job for Nihilus, which is a pretty slick little email client. And it looks like there's a software engineer for Datadog and a few other job listings there. So if you're looking for greener pastures, head on over to spec.fm/jobs. Also, I want to say thanks to Spec for having us, as always, taking care of us and making sure I don't say anything dumb on the air. Shout out to Mikhail. If you're looking for other design and developer-related podcasts, you should definitely head over to spec.fm. And again, we just want to say welcome to the React podcast. If you're into React and JSX and all that weird stuff, check that out. And let them know what you think of the show.
It's pronounced JS10. This episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport, who can only make us sound as intelligent as he wants us to, and produced by Sarah Jackson.
You know, I didn't think about that, but he does hold a lot of power over our heads.
He has a lot of creative control, for sure.
Yeah.
We don't give him a lot to work with.
No, we don't.
All right. Talk to you next week.
See ya.
Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Don't wait for your users to report errors. Iterate faster, improve your customers' happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at Sentry.io.